My name is Brian McGavin, and it's a pleasure to chair this session. When I was first approached about being a chair, I was asked what type of session I would like to chair, to which my response was something substantively historical, something by Michael Quinn. And my wishes were respected. Our presenter needs no introduction, as evidenced by the attendance we have here, so it's with great pleasure I take the time now and turn it over to him. It is anticipated the formal remarks will run through about 12:30 with about 15 or 20 minutes for questions from the audience. Michael.
The evolution of authority, priesthood, and ordained offices in Mormonism will not be obvious to those acquainted with official LDS doctrine and history. There have been significant changes in the public texts of LDS scripture and in original church documents published by official histories. These changes retroactively introduce concepts, persons, and structures which did not exist in the original revelations and historical documents. In some instances, these unannounced changes in critical texts altered or even reversed the original meanings of various statements. Beginning with Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, church leaders regarded these retroactive changes as necessary because the original documents did not adequately anticipate Mormonism's later developments. Quote, "When the Book of Doctrine and Covenants was compiled in 1834 for its publication in 1835, the church had then received many revelations to establish new offices and doctrines," David Whitmer wrote. Quote, "In a few years, they had gone way ahead of the written words, so that they had to change these revelations as originally published in the 1833 Book of Commandments," end quote. Another difficulty for understanding early Mormonism is the tendency for Mormons after 1835 to impose current church definitions on words and developments which had different meanings in the previous Mormon past. Although inconceivable to most modern Mormons, the concept of a Latter-day Church existed before there was a Mormon concept of the need for a religious organization, or for any religious ordinances whatever. In a revelation to Joseph Smith in the summer of 1828, God spoke of, quote, "the people, this people, and my people," unquote, before referring to, quote, "my church," unquote. This 1828 revelation equated "my people" with a non-institutional "my church." By contrast, the revelation rejected all organized religion as, quote, "they who do not fear me, neither keep my commandments, but build up churches unto themselves to get gain," unquote. This 1828 revelation did not offer any alternative for a Latter-day organized church that had God's approval. Instead, the revelation also specified that no religious ordinances would be required of the converts to "my church" in the latter days. Quote, "Behold, this is my doctrine. Whosoever repenteth and cometh unto me, the same is my church," unquote. And to erase all doubt that God's Latter-day, quote, "church," unquote, required no baptism of its converts, the 1828 revelation immediately stated, quote, "Whosoever declareth more or less than this, the same is not of me, but is against me. Therefore he is not of my church," unquote. By 1828, Joseph Smith's followers were part of a Latter-day Church which lacked any organized form and which required only professions of faith and repentance from its converts. No baptism was authorized or performed. In addition, a March 1829 revelation provided for a church, quote, "like unto the church which was taught by my disciples in the days of old," unquote, but the original manuscript and publication of the revelation said nothing about the need for priestly, quote, "authority," unquote. The Doctrine and Covenants subsequently added references to, quote, "power," and "you shall be ordained," and "ye are not yet ordained," unquote, to that March revelation. They were not in the original revelation. The previous month, a revelation had ignored the concept of ecclesiastical or priestly authority as a qualification for the Latter-day ministry. Instead, it specified requirements of, quote, "faith, hope, charity, and love, with an eye single to the glory of God," unquote, in order to be a Mormon minister. No mention of priesthood, no mention of authority. Not until Joseph Smith began dictating the Book of Mormon translation to Oliver Cowdery in April 1829 did the word "authority" or the requirement for baptism appear in any Mormon document. The control of priestly authority was implied in the angel Moroni's words to Joseph Smith, but those 1823 instructions were not described in a Mormon document until almost a decade after 1829. While engaged in translating the Book of Mormon, Smith and Cowdery baptized each other by immersion in May 1829. As his most thorough biographer has written, quote, to the converts, Joseph Smith's church was not only based upon the Book of Mormon, but the book was its reason for having come into existence, unquote. Therefore, the basic nature of the new church changed in Mormonism three times from mid-1828 to April 1830. First, from 1828 to May 1829, quote, my church, unquote, was an organized body of my people who had no priestly authority, and my church required no religious ordinances. Second, from mid-1829 onward, dozens of new converts were baptized into a community of believers, the Church of Christ, as it was called. Although this church still had no formal organization, Oliver Cowdery wrote an 1829 document titled, quote, Articles of the Church of Christ, unquote, which referred to the word authority and also described various ordinances and church offices. Its members were concentrated in three New York locations, Manchester Palmyra in Ontario County, Fayette in Seneca County, and Colesville in Broome County. Then Joseph Smith published the Book of Mormon in March 1830. As the third major change during this period, Joseph Smith formally organized the Church of Christ on 6 April 1830. In the remaining months of the year, the converts at Manchester, Fayette, and Colesville were organized into branches. David Whitmer preferred the Church of Christ to remain simply the spiritual community of believers. Quote, we were as fully organized spiritually before April 6th as we were on that day, he wrote. Originally called the Church of Christ in 1829 to 1830, it became the Church of the Latter-day Saints in 1834. In 1838, a revelation gave its final name as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. As late as February 1831, a revelation specified that there were only three ordained church offices, elders, priests, and teachers. That month, Joseph Smith ordained a man to the new office of bishop. He also provided for the office of deacon in April 1831 and ordained men to the office of high priest later that year. David Whitmer wrote, quote, we preached, baptized, and confirmed members into the Church of Christ from August 1829 until April 6, 1830, being 8 months, in which time we had proceeded rightly, the offices in the church being elders, priests, and teachers, unquote. Joseph Smith was first elder and Oliver Cowdery second elder. Joseph Smith's official history obscured the original date on which he and Cowdery were ordained as elders. The history says they were commanded to, quote, defer this our ordination until such times it should be practicable to have our brethren who had been and should be or baptized assembled together, when we must have their sanction to our thus proceeding to ordain each other, when also we were commanded to bless and break bread and break it with them, and to take wine and bless it and drink it with them, unquote. His history continued that on 6 April 1830, quote, according to the previous commandment, quote, unquote, he and Cowdery ordained each other elders. However, this was a reordination. Those ordinations to elder had first occurred almost a year before the church's organization. David Whitmer wrote that when he became a witness to the Book of Mormon in June 1829, quote, in this month I was also baptized, confirmed, and ordained an elder in the Church of Christ by Brother Joseph Smith. Previous to this, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery had baptized, confirmed, and ordained each other to the office of an elder in the Church of Christ, unquote. Cowdery's 1829 manuscript, titled Articles of the Church, also shows that elders were already in existence in 1829. Whitmer noted that the only new ordinance on April 6, 1830, occurred when Oliver Cowdery ordained Joseph Smith as, quote, prophet, seer, and revelator. The enabling revelation phrased this as a seer and a revelator, unquote. A seer and a prophet, unquote. At first, nearly everyone but Joseph Smith regarded him as a prophet among prophets, not as the prophet. David Whitmer described how Mormons viewed Joseph Smith up to September 1830. Quote, Brother Joseph gave many true prophecies when he was humble before God, but this is no more than many of the other brethren did, Whitmer wrote. Quote, Brothers Zibba Peterson, Hiram Page, Oliver Cowdery, Parley P. Pratt, Orson Pratt, Peter Whitmer, Christian Whitmer, John Whitmer, myself, and many others had the gift of prophecy, unquote. A well-known incident showed the power in such an egalitarian notion of prophet, seer, and revelator. During the late summer of 1830, Hiram Page used a seer stone to dictate written revelations as the word of God for members of the church here and now. Up to that time, none of Joseph Smith's revelations prohibited other saints from also declaring God's will for the church. Even Oliver Cowdery was, quote, believing much, unquote, in Page's revelations, although Cowdery had ordained Joseph Smith as a prophet, a seer, and a revelator 5 months earlier. That posed no difficulty for a church that was simply a spiritual community of believers. But non-hierarchical charisma could fragment an institutional church. Before the church's next conference in September 1830, Joseph Smith dictated a revelation that, quote, no one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church excepting my servant Joseph Smith, Jr., for he receiveth them as Moses, unquote. This revelation subordinated charisma, the gifts and revelations of God, to the authority of a single church leader. Sociologists of religion call this, quote, binding charisma within organizational forms, unquote. 5 months later, a woman's revelations resulted in an emphatic restatement of that position with one crucial addition. Joseph Smith dictated God's command that, quote, there is none other appointed unto you to receive commandments and revelations until he be taken, if he abide in me, and none else shall be appointed unto this gift, except it be through him. For if it be taken from him, he shall not have power except to appoint another in his stead, unquote. Therefore, as of February 1831, there could be no Mormon Elijah or Hosea arising from outside the priestly structure to declare God's word to his people. Joseph Smith was now a prophet like Moses in having an exclusive right to appoint his own prophetic successor. This applied even if Joseph Smith became a fallen prophet. In defining the church president's exclusive, quote, gift, unquote, to announce revelation, this revelation of February 1831 contradicted an earlier revelation. 2 years earlier, the original text of a revelation said, quote, and he, Joseph Smith, has a gift to translate the Book of Mormon, and I have commanded him that he shall pretend to no other gift, for I will grant him no other gift, unquote. That limit on Joseph Smith fit very well the unstructured community of Mormon believers in 1829. However, it was an obvious difficulty for his ascendancy as the sole revelator to an organized church from 1830 onward. This original text appeared without change in the 1833 Book of Commandments, the first published version or first published collection of Mormon revelations. But it became the earliest of many altered revelations in the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants as of 1835. The revised text reads to the present, quote, and you have a gift to translate the plates, and this is the first gift that I bestowed on you, added words. And I have commanded that you should pretend to no other gift until my purpose is fulfilled in this, added words. For I will grant unto you no other gift until it is finished, added words. These additions were necessary to make the earlier revelation consistent with Joseph Smith's post-1830 role as church president with sole right to announce revelations. The earliest Mormon use of the title apostle also poses some problems for present understanding. Both Mormons and non-Mormons connect the title with an unordained office and presiding quorum that didn't exist in Mormonism until 1835. The first reference to this office is a revelation of June 1829 to Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer, quote, I speak unto you, even as unto a Paul, mine apostle, for you were called even with that same calling with which he was called, unquote. It's crucial that the revelation used Paul to define this apostleship. Unlike the equally well-known apostles Peter, James, and John, the New Testament mentions no literal ordination for the apostle Paul by the laying on of hands. Instead, because of his vision on the road to Damascus, Paul was, quote, an apostle, not of men, neither by men, but by Jesus Christ, unquote. The LDS Church's Dictionary of the Bible acknowledges that Paul and Barnabas may have been, quote, apostles strictly in the sense of being special witnesses of the Lord Jesus Christ, unquote. Into the mid-19th century, Mormon leaders continued to use the word apostle for unordained charisma. Although the Book of Acts recorded that the martyr Stephen was one of the seven ordained deacons of the early Christian church, LDS Apostle John Taylor called him Apostle Stephen. Why? Because Stephen saw a vision of God and Jesus Christ. The 1829 revelation called Oliver Cowdery and Whitmer apostles because they, with Joseph Smith and later with Martin Harris, were special witnesses of the Book of Mormon. These four men heard God's voice and, quote, viewed the plates in a vision, unquote. This is from an official publication of the church recently, that included the angel Moroni. Like Paul on the road to Damascus, Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon's three witnesses saw a light and heard a voice in 1829. Thereby, Joseph Smith and the three witnesses had the revealed calling of apostle in 1829 without literal ordination by the laying on of hands. Reflecting that 1829 view of a Mormon apostleship, William E. McClellan, who later received actual ordination by the laying on of hands to the office of apostle, wrote, quote, "An apostle is not an administrative officer. When they ministered, they did it as elders," unquote. A recent interpreter has observed, quote, "These apostles had received their callings charismatically through vision rather than institutionally through ordination to office," unquote. This 1829 revelation stated, quote, "The 12 shall be my disciples," unquote, and commanded Cowdery and Whitmer, quote, "to search out the 12," unquote. Official LDS histories cite this 1829 revelation as the basis for the three witnesses choosing and ordaining a quorum of 12 apostles in 1835. These histories don't explain why the command was unfulfilled for 6 years, or why the witnesses would risk God's displeasure by ignoring the command for that long. The wording of the 1829 revelation was that they should, quote, "search out the 12 now." Furthermore, LDS histories don't explain why there were newspaper references from 1829 to 1831 to 12 apostles in Mormonism. In September 1829, a Palmyra newspaper noted, quote, "The number of the Gold Bible apostles is said to be complete," unquote. That implied there were already 12 Mormon apostles. In November 1830, the Cleveland Herald said that the Mormon Church, quote, "had sent out 12 apostles to promulgate its doctrines," unquote. Ezra Booth wrote in November 1831 that Zibba Peterson was, quote, "one of the 12 apostles," unquote. As one of the first Mormons to be ordained to the high priesthood, which we'll discuss later, Booth supports the conclusion that the Palmyra newspapers in 1829 meant 12 when it referred to the required number of, quote, "Gold Bible apostles," unquote. A closer look at the church's first conference of June 1830 puts the 1829 revelation and Booth's observation in a new light. 8 days before the church's organization, evangelical preacher David Marks met with the Whitmer witnesses to the Book of Mormon. Quote, "They further stated that 12 apostles were to be appointed, who would soon confirm their mission by miracles," unquote. That appointment did not occur at the formal organization of the church on April 6th, at which only 6 men were prominent. At the new church's first conference of 9 June 1830, the organization had only 12 officers. Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery were first and second elders. David Whitmer, John Whitmer, Peter Whitmer, Zibba Peterson, and Samuel H. Smith were also elders. Martin Harris, Hiram Smith, and Joseph Smith Sr. were priests. Hiram Page and Christian Whitmer were teachers. These 7 elders of June 1830 may have seen themselves as a restoration of the, quote, 7, unquote, prominent Christians who were deacons in the early apostolic church. In any event, deacons were not actually ordained in the new church until 1831, and the office of deacon was then retroactively added to the revelation of April 1830 as it now exists in the Doctrine and Covenants. The June 1830 conference gave each of these 12 officers a written license. John Whitmer's license reads, quote, "Given to John Whitmer, signifying and proving that he is an apostle of Jesus Christ, an elder of this church," unquote. This document was signed by Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith, each as, quote, "an apostle of Jesus Christ," unquote. In 1831, Sidney Rigdon also wrote that John Whitmer is, quote, "an apostle of this church," unquote. Therefore, of the 7 elders at the church's first conference, we have evidence that 5 were specifically called apostles in the 1829 to 31 period: Joseph Smith, Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, John Whitmer, and Zibba Peterson. The Articles and Covenants of the Church of Christ said that, quote, "an apostle is an elder," unquote. Therefore, the remaining 2 elders of this first conference, Peter Whitmer and Samuel H. Smith, were also designated as apostles in their elders' licenses. Were the five non-elders at this first conference also known as apostles? The license of Joseph Smith Sr., who was a priest, and of Christian Whitmer, teacher, did not give them the title of apostle. Thus, apostolic designation was not connected with the offices of priest and teacher. However, Joseph Smith's statement to the School of the Prophets 3 years later, to be discussed shortly, explained that the title apostle applied to those who had received a vision. Charismatic or visionary experience is what distinguished the Church's 12 officers at the June 1830 conference, and that is why all 12 of them were regarded as apostles that year. 11 of the Church's first 12 officers in June 1830 were witnesses to the Book of Mormon, and these were the men who fulfilled the 1829's revelation command to choose, quote, 12 disciples, unquote. First, four men, Joseph Smith and the three witnesses, saw the light of an angel and heard God's voice in June 1829. Then Joseph Smith showed eight other men the gold plates, but they did not see an angel or hear the voice of God. For Mormonism, these eight were also special witnesses and apostles of God's wondrous work. John Whitmer, called an apostle in his 1830 license, was one of the eight witnesses. Although existing records do not specify who selected the eight witnesses in June 1829, their selection came within days of the revelation to Cowdery and Whitmer to seek out, quote, 12 disciples, unquote. Cowdery, Whitmer, and Harris were already called by revelation to be three special witnesses, and the first two chose the remaining eight men of the Book of Mormon's 12 special witnesses, including Joseph Smith himself. That was the understanding the Whitmers gave preacher David Marks in March 1830. They first said that, quote, 12 chosen witnesses had been allowed to see the gold plates, unquote, and then added that 12 apostles were to be appointed, unquote. That apostolic appointment within the new church occurred at the June 1830 conference. For unknown reasons, the first church conference substituted Zibba Peterson in place of the 12th Book of Mormon witness, Jacob Whitmer. Early church members like Ezra Booth understood that all 12 ordained officers at the first conference had the additional calling of apostle, even the substituted Peterson. Thus, in 1829-30, apostle first meant charismatic apostleship of being a special witness of God and His Word. That helps explain why, to modern Mormons, there is a curious lack of hierarchy or ranking in the offices of elder, priest, and teacher during 1830-31. For example, in the June 1830 conference, the Book of Mormon witnesses were divided up among the three offices without any reference to age or status. The two oldest men, Joseph Smith Sr. and Martin Harris, were priests. The two teachers, Hiram Page and Christian Whitmer, were older than all the elders at the first conference, with the possible exception of Zibba Peterson, whose birth date is unknown. Joseph Smith's consistently devoted older brother, Hiram, was a priest. His equally devoted younger brother, Samuel, was an elder. In June 1830, the church's seven elders included two of the three witnesses, only three of the eight witnesses, and one regular church member. That apparent lack of ranking in priesthood offices continued to the conference a full year later. Martin Harris was still a priest, and two of the eight witnesses to the Book of Mormon were still teachers, even though 38 Mormons of far lesser distinction held the office of elder. With the exception of Joseph Smith as first elder and Oliver Cowdery as second elder, which related to the chronology of their ordination, the three priesthood offices of early Mormonism had different functions, but no discernible difference in status. Even the 1831 list of officers, elder, priest, and teacher, seems merely their alphabetical order, not ranking of importance. The concept of higher or lower office did not seem to exist for Mormon church offices until the 1831 introduction of high priesthood, to be discussed. In 1831, elder, priest, and teacher became offices of descending authority in Mormonism. Those definitions were then retroactively introduced into the revelations and documents of 1829-30. For example, in the Book of Mormon, dictated in 1829, both teachers and priests had authority to baptize, but only elders could ordain other church offices. Then in 1831, the revision of Oliver Cowdery's 1829 Articles of the Church, teachers no longer had the authority to baptize, whereas priests could both baptize and ordain. Those administrative changes were retroactively added to an 1830 revelation in Doctrine and Covenants, Section 20. By the end of 1830, the designation, but not ordination, of apostle also included an evangelical apostleship of missionary service. In December 1830, two of these original 12 apostles of Mormonism referred to Orson Pratt as, quote, another servant and apostle, unquote. Pratt explained in 1847 that, quote, 17 years ago, 1830, in Father Whitmer's chamber, Brother Joseph got a revelation through the Urim and Thummim, Searstone, that I should be one of the 12, unquote. The revelation to Pratt in November 1830 simply said, quote, you were called of me to preach my gospel, unquote. Orson Pratt's 1830 apostleship had nothing to do with visionary witness, because throughout his life, Orson grieved that he never had a vision. Mormon missionaries were called apostles as late as the end of 1832. In September 1831, Jared Carter's diary recorded that, quote, he received the authority of an apostle, unquote, before going on a proselytizing mission. The index of the Curtin Revelation book stated that a two-day revelation of Joseph Smith to six elders and, quote, 11 high priests save one, unquote, on 22-23 December 1832 was for, quote, commissioning the apostles to preach the gospel, unquote. The text of the 1832 revelation told these missionaries, quote, you are mine apostles, even God's high priests, unquote, and instructed them to, quote, go into all the world and preach, unquote. In early Mormonism, these evangelical apostles, like the charismatic ones, were not ordained to the office of apostle by the laying on of hands. Charismatic apostleship without ordination reemerged prominently in 1833. Joseph Smith's description of 24 temples to comprise the temple complex of Zion, Independence, Missouri, included three temples designated for, quote, the sacred apostolic repository, unquote. A clue to what Joseph Smith meant by apostolic is in a revelation that same month of June 1833 concerning the temple at Kirtland, Ohio. Quote, and let the higher part of the inner court be dedicated unto me for the school of mine apostles, saith Son Ammon, unquote. In March 1833, the Kirtland School of the Prophets had experienced a vision which qualified several attenders as charismatic apostles. Zebedee Coltrane later testified that during a meeting of this adult education school, he and others present saw two separate personages, quote, surrounded as with a flame of fire, unquote. Joseph Smith then told the school, quote, brethren, now you are prepared to be the apostles of Jesus Christ, for you have seen both the Father and the Son, unquote. The revelation of June 1830 confirmed their apostolic designation, but Kirtland's School of the Prophets did not become apostles by ordination with laying on of hands. Not until 1835 did the unordained calling of apostle become an ordained office in Mormonism. Then the three witnesses again fulfilled the 1829 revelation to select, quote, 12 disciples, unquote. In 1835, Mormon apostleship was by ordination, like Matthias, as well as both charismatic and evangelical, like Paul's apostleship. However, this quorum of 12 ordained apostles did not include any of the Book of Mormon's apostolic witnesses in 1829. Nor did the ordained apostleship of 1835 include Zebedee Coltrane and other designated apostles from the 1833 School of the Prophets. Early Mormons also understood that there was only one kind of authority at the church's organization. As late as 1834, Oliver Cowdery's words reflected that earlier view. He described a visitation of John the Baptist to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery in 1829, quote, and we received under his hands the holy priesthood, unquote. Then he quoted the angel's words, quote, upon you, my fellow servants, in the name of Messiah, I confer this priesthood and this authority, which remain upon the earth, that the sons of Levi may yet offer an offering unto the Lord in righteousness, unquote. This was the first time most Mormons learned that a heavenly conferral of authority occurred before the church's organization. Cowdery's words indicate a restoration of only one priesthood, or authority. The more familiar version of this priesthood restoration prayer was first published in 1842, and now appears in the Doctrine and Covenants as Section 13. A careful examination of Section 13 shows that Cowdery's 1834 prayer text was its source, to which was retroactively added an entire central portion. This addition made the 1829 wording appear to be a prelude for the later division of church authority into the lesser, or Aaronic priesthood, and the greater, or Melchizedek priesthood. By these later definitions, only the Melchizedek priesthood was, quote, the holy priesthood, unquote. This analysis will frequently use that later definition of Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods in discussing the first years of Mormonism. This will suggest how the 1830 church was understood by its earliest members once they adopted the rigid concepts of Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods. Such analysis may also help current Mormons who perceive all religious history from that dual priesthood perspective. However, it is anachronistic to apply the terms Melchizedek and Aaronic to Mormon concepts of authority before 1832, even up to 1835. It is difficult to avoid all anachronisms in a situation where virtually every standard and familiar published text has been filled with statements introduced after the dates of the original events and manuscript texts. Therefore, a careful reading of Cowdery's 1834 History of Priesthood Restoration puzzles modern Mormons for two reasons. By the way, it is in the published Doctrine and Covenants today as a footnote to Section 13. The puzzlement occurs first because Cowdery said John the Baptist restored, quote, the holy priesthood, unquote, when modern Mormons know he conferred the Aaronic priesthood, not the holy priesthood of Melchizedek. Second, Cowdery's 1834 history doesn't refer to any restoration of a second priesthood. All official church histories after 1834 refer to a visitation of ancient Peter, James, and John, who gave the holy Melchizedek priesthood to Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery. Accounts of this second priesthood restoration began appearing in documents recorded in 1835. In August, the church published the first edition of the Doctrine and Covenants, which added passages to previously published revelations. In a revised 1830 revelation, an addition referred to the 1829 visit of John the Baptist as ordaining, quote, you unto the first priesthood which you have received, even as Aaron, unquote. Then the 1835 editors added these words to the 1830 revelation, quote, and also with Peter, James, and John, whom I have sent unto you, by whom I have ordained you and confirmed you to be apostles, especial witnesses of my name, and bear the keys of your ministry and of these same things which I revealed unto them, unquote. Those phrases appeared nowhere in the first official publication of Joseph Smith's revelations in the 1833 Book of Commandment, nor did those words appear in the 1830 revelations only manuscript. When introducing the Church's first book of recorded patriarchal blessings on 28 September 1835, Oliver Cowdery referred to the two angelic ministrations. He wrote of the appearance of the first angel, quote, who bestowed upon us the priesthood, as I have said, we repaired to the water and were baptized. After this we received the high and holy priesthood, but an account of this will be given elsewhere, or in another place, unquote. In the same book, 4 days later, Cowdery recorded Joseph's blessing to him, which said that the two had been ordained, quote, by the hand of the angel in the bush, unto the lesser priesthood, and after received the holy priesthood under the hands of they who had been held in reserve for a long season, even those who received it under the hand of the Messiah, unquote. Cowdery's 1835 document indicated that this was a blessing Joseph Smith gave him on 18 December 1830, but it was actually one he received on 22 September 1835. In December 1833, the prophet had recorded the prayer blessing on Oliver Cowdery's behalf, which warned that there, quote, are two evils in him he must needs forsake, or he cannot altogether escape the buffetings of the adversary, unquote. That was the 1833 revelation, not the one that referred to Peter, James, and John. No contemporary details are the 1833 blessing to Oliver Cowdery, not the one that referred to Peter, James, and John. No contemporary details are available, but Brigham Young and others later described Cowdery's, quote, evils, unquote. In 1833, newly married Oliver Cowdery had either committed simple adultery or entered into an unauthorized plural marriage that Joseph Smith defined as adulterous. Cowdery's substitution of the 1835 blessing for the 1833 document had two benefits. It omitted the earlier document's allusion to Cowdery's sexual misconduct, and also retroactively provided another pre-1835 reference to Peter, James, and John. This was consistent with the reference to the three angels that Smith and Cowdery had already added to the 1830 revelation as published in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. The point of this textual discussion is not to question the truthfulness of statements by Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery that there was, in fact, a second restoration of authority, and that this, in fact, occurred through angelic ministration. Instead, this discussion points out the problems retroactive changes have caused in understanding the documents and events of pre-1835 Mormonism. Also, official LDS history and its apologists have erred in assuming Smith's and Cowdery's vague statements meant 1829 was the year Peter, James, and John ministered to them. In fact, when retroactive changes are eliminated from original documents, all evidence shows the angelic restoration of apostolic authority did not occur until after the Church's organization on 6 April 1830. Curiously, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery kept the two angelic restorations secret for years. When Cowdery referred to baptism in his Articles of the Church of Christ in 1829, he wrote that this authority was, quote, given me of Jesus Christ, end quote, but mentioned no ministration by John the Baptist. Joseph Smith's official history explains, quote, in the meantime, we were forced to keep secret the circumstances of having received the priesthood and our having been baptized owing to a spirit of persecution which had already been manifested in the neighborhood, unquote. As early as the fall of 1830, non-Mormons knew that Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery claimed to have seen God and angels and to have received divine authority. The Painesville Telegraph reported in November 1830 that Oliver Cowdery, quote, pretends to have a divine mission and to have seen and conversed with angels, unquote. That could have been a reference to the published testimony of Cowdery and the other three witnesses in the Book of Mormon. However, the following month, this Ohio newspaper linked, quote, authority with Cowdery's visions. Quote, Mr. Oliver Cowdery has received his commission directly from the God of heaven, and that he has his credentials written and signed by the hand of Jesus Christ, with whom he has personally conversed, and as such, said Cowdery claims that he and his associates are the only persons on earth who were qualified to administer in his name. By this authority, they proclaim to the world that all who do not believe their testimony and be baptized by them for the remission of sins must be forever miserable, unquote. In New York, the Palmyra Reflector stated in February 1831 that Mormon missionaries were preaching that, quote, Joseph Smith had now received a commission from God, unquote, and that, quote, Smith, they affirmed, had seen God frequently and personally. Cowdery and his friends had frequent interviews with angels, unquote. However, the newspaper accounts show that their Mormon sources claim Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery had seen angels, but had obtained authority directly from God, not through angelic administration. In fact, until Cowdery's published history in October 1834, the restoration of authority or priesthood by angels was unknown to the church generally. Angelic restorations were equally unknown among Joseph Smith's most trusted confidants. Joseph Smith's own mother made no reference to angelic restoration of authority in an 1831 letter she wrote to her brother about the new church. If she knew about angelic restoration of divine authority, Lucy Mack Smith chose not to mention it in her enthusiastic defense of the new church. Such an omission is curious in a defense of Mormonism written by its founder's mother. Although appointed an apostle in 1829 to 1830, David Whitmer later insisted, quote, neither did I ever hear of such a thing as an angel ordaining them until I got into Ohio, about the year 1834 or later, unquote. Whitmer concluded, quote, I do not believe that John the Baptist ever ordained Joseph and Oliver as stated and believed by some, unquote. Whitmer's disbelief is irrelevant, but his lack of knowledge of the report until 1834 is significant. William E. McClellan made a similar statement, quote, in 1831 I heard Joseph Smith tell his experience about angel visits many times and about finding the plates and their contents coming to light, McClellan wrote. But I never heard one word of John the Baptist or of Peter, James, and John's visit and ordination until I was told some year or two afterward in Ohio, unquote. In August 1832, McClellan certainly reflected that sincere lack of knowledge in a long letter to his family in which he explained his conversion to Mormonism and presented Mormon claims. McClellan's 1832 letter referred to the angel Moroni visits but showed no knowledge of any other angelic ministrations. It is especially puzzling that as late as 1833, Joseph Knight had no knowledge of priesthood restorations. Knight had been a confidant and ally of Joseph Smith since the early 1820s and became an early convert. About 1833, Knight wrote a history of important events of Mormonism up to that year. Knight's history made no reference to either John the Baptist or to Peter, James, and John. This omission is significant because Knight was eager to discuss angelic ministrations. His history is the only Mormon source for the details of the angel Moroni's annual visits with Joseph Smith from 1823 to 1827, yet he makes no reference to John the Baptist or to Peter, James, and John. In the same year, Joseph Knight made no reference to angelic restorations of authority. Joseph Smith omitted such reference in a public sermon about seeing Christ's ancient apostles. During the last week of February, 1833, Joseph Smith preached near Cleveland, Ohio, that quote, he had seen Jesus Christ and the apostles and conversed with them, unquote. Here again, the prophet claimed converse with apostolic angels, possibly Peter, James, and John, but he mentioned no commission of authority from those angels. Until 1834, the vast majority of early Mormons knew nothing about the visit of John the Baptist, and did not learn until 1835 of the visit of Peter, James, and John. There was no reference to those visitations in the Church's first official compilation of revelations, the 1833 Book of Commandments. For the first 4 years of the new Church, prominent Mormons either never referred to or never heard about Joseph Smith's receiving authority from angels, other than the angel Moroni's ministrations concerning the Book of Mormon. According to the evidence, only Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery knew. Mass ignorance of an event has no bearing on the event's occurrence, but early silence about angelic restorations of authority does show something very significant about early Mormons. A Catholic historian accurately noted that Mormonism's claims to authority had tremendous appeal to early converts. That is certainly reflected in the newspaper report of December 1830 that Oliver Cowdery claimed, quote, he and his associates are the only persons on earth who are qualified to administer in God's name, unquote. However, the above evidence also shows that early converts defended Mormon claims without testifying that angels conferred that authority on Joseph Smith. By contrast, such an omission would be inconceivable to modern Mormons. Since the 1840s, every explanation of the Church's claims to authority has included some mention of the angelic restoration by John the Baptist and by Peter, James, and John. Why did pre-1835 defenses of the Mormon faith omit today's essential explanation of LDS Church authority? One explanation is that early Mormons, unlike later Mormons, emphasized authority based on what one interpreter has called, quote, charismatic or spiritual power, not on priesthood ordination, unquote. Still, that does not explain why priesthood restoration by angels was a secret known only to Smith and Cowdery for 4 years after the ordination of the organization of the Church. Nor does this help date the visit of Peter, James, and John. Then there is the contrast between the two men's eventual descriptions of the two priesthood restorations. Oliver Cowdery and Joseph Smith gave detailed descriptions of John the Baptist's visit. On the other hand, both men gave unusually vague accounts of the restoration of authority by Peter, James, and John. Cowdery's personal accounts of the second restoration of authority did not name the angel or angels involved until after Joseph Smith's death. In 1846, he wrote that the restoration of the greater priesthood occurred, quote, in the presence of Peter, unquote. And in 1849, Cowdery wrote, quote, Peter, James, and John, holding the keys of the Melchizedek priesthood, have also ministered, unquote. This was Oliver Cowdery's most detailed description of the second angelic restoration. Joseph Smith's 1832 history about early Mormonism mentioned only, quote, the reception of the holy priesthood by the ministering of angels, unquote. Nevertheless, Joseph Smith may have intended this 1832 reference to unnamed angels as a reference to deity rather than to John the Baptist or to Peter, James, and John. For example, Joseph once described his first vision of God and Jesus as, quote, the first visitation of angels, which was when I was about 14 years old, unquote. In any case, Joseph Smith did not publish or circulate his 1832 history, and first spoke to others in February 1834 about his having previously received an angelic conferral of authority. At the organization of the Kirtland High Council, the church president said, quote, I shall now endeavor to set forth before this council the dignity of the office, which has been conferred upon me by the ministering of the angel of God, by his own will and by the voice of this church, unquote. Significantly, as late as February 1834, the prophet still mentioned only one angel as the agent of restoration of authority. At that time, Joseph Smith gave early Mormons no reason to look beyond the angel Moroni for that unnamed angel's identity. 8 months later, however, Oliver Cowdery announced that it was actually John the Baptist. There is no record of Joseph Smith giving further details about angelic restorations until the additions he made in 1835 to an 1830 revelation. And then in 1838, he began an expanded narrative of his personal history. He announced that he prepared this official history to, quote, put all inquirers after truth in possession of the facts as they have transpired in relation to myself and to the church, so far as I have such facts in my possession, unquote. In this 1838 document, he precisely identified John the Baptist as appearing on 15 May 1829, but only vaguely added that this angel, quote, acted Peter, James, and John, who held the keys of the priesthood of Melchizedek, which priesthood, he said, would in due time be conferred on us, unquote. It is extraordinary that in his official history, Joseph Smith said a crucial event was to occur, quote, in due time, unquote, and then dropped the subject completely. He never referred to the actual occurrence of this restoration of the, quote, keys of the priesthood of Melchizedek, unquote, in his official history of the, quote, facts as they have transpired in relation to both myself and the church, unquote. Subsequent church histories have lamented this lack of dating the second angelic restoration of authority. Yet they ignore the inevitable question. Why did Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery repeatedly avoid saying specifically that Peter, James, and John restored it in 1829? Such vagueness is more than accidental in Joseph Smith's history, which gave at least season, month, and year for the first vision, Moroni, John the Baptist, and the three witnesses' experiences with angels and deity. For the unbeliever who regards these claims of Smith and Cowdery as either fraudulent or delusional, this vagueness must be an equal puzzle. Why would the two men refrain from simply inventing a date for an experience only they could confirm? The answer is that they were vague in order to avoid being dishonest. First, there is no evidence that a restoration of Melchizedek priesthood, as later defined, happened in June 1829. Second, the evidence is that the second priesthood restoration by angels occurred more than a year later than assumed in traditional Mormon history. Joseph Smith gave the first clue when he began publishing his official history in 1842 and spoke about the sequence of angelic restoration administrations. First, he mentioned the angel Moroni visit, September 1823. Then the voice of God speaking to the three witnesses as they saw Moroni and the gold plates, June 1829. Next, he described, quote, the voice of Michael on the banks of the Susquehanna, detecting the devil when he appeared as an angel of light. The voice of Peter, James, and John in the wilderness between Harmony, Susquehanna County, and Colesville, Broome County, on the Susquehanna River, declaring themselves as possessing the keys of the kingdom, unquote. This is published in Doctrine and Covenants 124. Circumstantial evidence indicates that the appearance of the angel Michael occurred in June 1830. More important, the reference to Colesville is crucial for dating the visit of Peter, James, and John as having occurred in July 1830. And not before. Both events involved the Knight family. Newell Knight and his father Joseph lived in Colesville, one of the three branches of Mormons in New York State in mid-1830. During a meeting at Joseph Knight's house, Newell Knight experienced a seizure while attempting to pray. He asked Joseph Smith to, quote, cast the devil out of him, unquote, which the prophet did as, quote, the first miracle wrought in this church, unquote. Joseph Smith's manuscript history originally dated the first miracle of the new church as occurring after the 9 June 1830 conference. At the end of June, New York authorities arrested Joseph Smith for performing this exorcism. Following the new church's first experience with the devil, Joseph Smith dictated the revelation concerning Satan. Dated June 1830, this revelation said that Satan appeared to Moses and pretended to be Jesus Christ. It is well known that Joseph Smith dictated written revelations in response to specific events or inquiries. Rather than being in response to the night exorcism, this June 1830 revelation of the, quote, vision of Moses, unquote, was a direct parallel to the modern prophet's recent experience with, quote, the voice of Michael on the banks of the Susquehanna, detecting the devil when he appeared as an angel of light, unquote, June 1830. Joseph's official history shows that in June 1830, he next made an important trip to Colesville, Broome County, New York. Church documents vaguely date this after the 9 June 1830 conference, but judicial records show that the Colesville visit began the last week of June 1830. It was not Joseph Smith's first day with his friend Joseph Knight in Colesville, but this trip is crucial for dating the appearance of Peter, James, and John. The official church history, court documents, and the later account by John Reed, a lawyer from Colesville who represented Joseph Smith, described the events and duration of that visit. Joseph Smith held a conference in Colesville on Sunday, 27 June 1830, and baptized converts the morning of June 28. He was arrested the Monday evening of June 28 before he could perform the new, confirm the new converts as members of the church. Then a court tried Joseph Smith all day June 29th and acquitted him for disorderly conduct after midnight. He was rearrested in the early morning hours of Wednesday, June 30th on a separate charge of disorderly conduct, was tried again on June 30th beginning at 10 a.m. The second trial continued throughout the day and all night until the Court of Three Justices acquitted him about 5 a.m. on Thursday, June 1st. With the assistance of the constable, Joseph's lawyer helped him escape the local citizens who were angry at the second acquittal. Then the prophet met his wife at her sister's house later that Thursday morning. He returned with his wife Emma to their house in Harmony, Pennsylvania, quote, the next day, unquote, which would be Friday, July 2nd. Cowdery went on this trip to Colesville but didn't accompany Joseph and Emma during their return to Harmony on July 2nd. Details of the first trip were crucial for dating the next journey Joseph and Oliver made alone, quote, after a few days, unquote, to confirm the converts in Colesville. This was in obedience to two revelations dated only July 1830. The first told Joseph Smith, quote, thou hast been delivered from all thine enemies, unquote, which obviously referred to the two recent acquittals and his escape from the Colesville mobs. Then this revelation commanded, quote, go speedily unto the church which is in Colesville, Fayette, and Manchester, unquote. The second revelation narrowed that command to, quote, confirming the church at Colesville, unquote, who had been baptized but not confirmed. Here, Joseph Smith's history gave no reference to a Sunday meeting which would date the trip exactly. He and Cowdery probably timed their arrival in Colesville near nightfall of Monday, July 5th. This was exactly 1 week after a mob and his first arrest prevented confirmation of the newly baptized Mormons in Colesville. Despite their precautions, quote, we had scarcely arrived at Mr. Knight's when the mob was seen collecting together to oppose us, and we considered it wisdom to leave for home, which we did without even waiting for any refreshments, unquote. The mob chased them, and, quote, we managed to get home after having traveled all night, except a short time during which we were forced to rest ourselves under a large tree by a wayside, sleeping and watching alternately. Quote, that's from his official history, which you have available to you. Thus, Joseph's history shows that in early July 1830, probably the night of July 5th to 6th, he and Cowdery made an arduous nighttime escape from mobs at Colesville, New York. After traveling all night, they arrived in Harmony after daybreak. This corresponds with Joseph's later statement about the Melchizedek priesthood restoration being on the Susquehanna between Colesville and Harmony. In addition, Erastus Snow, an 1833 convert and apostle since 1849, preached that when Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, quote, were being pursued by their enemies and they had to travel all night, and that Peter, James, and John appeared to them, quote, in the dawn of the coming day when they were weary and worn, unquote. This was the morning of July 6, 1830, exactly 3 months after the church's organization. In 1844, Addison Everett overheard a discussion between Joseph and Hiram Smith about the ministration of Peter, James, and John, which followed a trial at Colesville. 38 years old at the time of the conversation, Everett described it in letters of 1881 and 1882. The first appears in a diary well known to Mormon scholars. Quote, Joseph and Oliver went to the woods in a few rods, it being night, and they traveled until Oliver was exhausted and Joseph almost carried him through the mud and water. They traveled all night, and just at the break of day, Oliver gave out entirely and exclaimed, O Lord, how long, Brother Joseph, have we got to endure this thing? Brother Joseph said that at that very time, Peter, James, and John came to them and ordained them to the apostleship, unquote. The 1882 letter by Everett added that Joseph Smith made these statements to five or six men at the Mansion House in June 1840. And that he said this angelic appearance was on the banks of the Susquehanna River. Everett assumed this occurred at the time of the translation of the Book of Mormon in 1829. But significantly, he added that Peter, James, and John appeared during the time Joseph Smith's attorney was a, quote, lawyer by the name of Reeder, I think his name was, unquote. Everett's accounts are the final evidence for dating the Second Priesthood Restoration. Joseph Smith's history specified that John Reed was his attorney at the trials which judicial records show ended on Thursday, 1 July, 1830. Apostle Snow's description of the Second Priesthood Restoration matches the prophet's account of the return trip to Harmony from Colesville during the first week of July, 1830. Everett's description of the harrowing return journey from Colesville by the tool men is the last link. This provides the direct corroboration of the 1830 date implied in Joseph Smith's official history for the appearance of Peter, James, and John. Therefore, Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery received the administration of Peter, James, and John at dawn during the first week of July, 1830, probably on July 6th. Richard L. Bushman was the first Mormon historian to acknowledge this evidence. His 1984 biography of Joseph Smith concludes that the restoration occurred in the summer of 1830. Bushman observes that a July 1830 appearance of James and John is further supported by the first reference to their visit in the Doctrine and Covenants. Joseph Smith chose to make this retroactive addition to the text of the Revelation immediately following the revelation which instructed him to travel to Colesville in July 1830. Therefore, by later LDS definitions, Joseph Smith organized the church in 1830 without the Melchizedek priesthood. He founded the new church on 6 April 1830 solely with the authority he received from John the Baptist almost a year earlier. By later definition, this means that the new church was exclusively an Aaronic priesthood organization during its first 3 months. In fact, Church President Brigham Young later affirmed this. He stated, as church president, publicly, quote, Joseph Smith organized the church, for the Lord had revealed to him the Aaronic priesthood upon which the church was organized, unquote. President Young added that Joseph Smith, quote, received the Melchizedek priesthood from Peter, James, and John after the church's organization. The evidence discussed above shows that the priesthood restoration by Peter, James, and John occurred 3 months after the church's organization. For example, church historian Franklin D. Richards told the Quorum of 12 Apostles in 1897 that Joseph Smith received the Melchizedek priesthood from Peter, James, and John about the time of his June-July 1830 trials. During the first half of 1830, all the church officers, teachers, priests, and elders, and its prophet and himself held only the authority of what was later called the lesser priesthood. At its April 1830 organization, the LDS Church reflected the Old Testament model of teachers, priests, elders, seers, and prophets. However, by 1835, it was easier for Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery to be vague about the date for the Melchizedek priesthood's restoration by Peter, James, and John. The 1830 Church did not conform exactly with the doctrinal statements published from 1835 onward. The 1835 Doctrine and Covenants published a revelation on priesthood that the holy priesthood of Melchizedek, quote, continueth in the church of God in all generations, unquote. Traditionally dated as 1832 in origin, this revelation was extraordinarily important as the first detailed explanation of priesthood, but it did not appear in the 1833 Book of Commandments, nor was it published in the church's periodical in Missouri during that time period. Therefore, no difficulty with that book's unaltered revelations about priesthood. The addition of this priesthood reference in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants made it awkward to explain that Joseph Smith organized the church in April 1830 without the Melchizedek priesthood. An explanation then would have been far easier for Mormons of 1835 than for those of the 1890s who have been taught to see Mormon history as seamless. Nevertheless, the explanation simply shifts the perspective in a way that need not be disturbing to those who believe in the angelic restorations of priesthood. Rather than having two priesthood orders, the early LDS Church fulfilled religious seekers who sought two different religious authorities, a divine calling and a conferred authority. By combining present perspective and unaltered original documents, we can understand that from April to July 1830, the LDS Church had two bases of authority. First, the publicly acknowledged charismatic calling of a living prophet in the Old Testament mold. Second, the virtually unknown authority given by John the Baptist and kept secret. The concept of charismatic prophet changed only with respect to exclusivity. The concept of his authority expanded several times in Mormonism. Those changes were important since Smith and Cowdery, for 5 years after 1829, were the only ones who knew about or conferred basis for their authority. Until Oliver Cowdery's published 1834 history and the retroactive changes in the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, there was nothing in Mormonism to attract converts who expected angelically conferred authority, or who expected literal restoration of apostolic authority. Divine calling, or charisma, was the only basis of authority that early Mormon converts knew until the publication of Cowdery's history in October 1834. After 6 July 1830, the Church's two highest officers had new authority of Peter, James, and John. Nevertheless, Joseph Smith waited another year to tell Church members that there were distinctions of authority or priesthood. Even then, he did not tell them those distinctions derived from angelic ministrations. In June 1831, Joseph Smith announced there was a, quote, high priesthood, unquote, which for the first time gave all previous Church authority and ordination a lesser stature. Joseph Smith gave no administrative definitions of high priesthood in 1831, but said, quote, that the order of the high priesthood is that they have power given them to seal up the saints unto eternal life, unquote. By 1835, Joseph Smith explained the lesser as Aaronic priesthood and the higher as Melchizedek priesthood. He then retroactively introduced these distinctions into the publication of pre-1835 revelations and historical documents. As a further complication, the officer of elder in the 1830 church straddled two priesthoods, as that designation did in the Old and New Testaments. Since church members in 1829-33 knew nothing about the visits of John the Baptist or the three ancient apostles, newly ordained Mormon elders saw their office as no different from Old Testament elders, whose priesthood was Levitical or Aaronic by later definition, or even by definition within the Old Testament. With this hidden knowledge of angel visits, Joseph Smith ordained elders from June 1829 to July 1830 by the authority he received from John the Baptist, without any further angelic restoration of authority. His official history demonstrated that, even as it sought to retroactively introduce in 1829, the later concept of Melchizedek priesthood, quote, we now became anxious to have that promise realized to us which the angel that conferred upon us the Aaronic priesthood had given us. In other words, that provided we should continue faithful, we should also have the Melchizedek priesthood. His official history began for June 1829. Continuing, quote, to our unspeakable satisfaction did we realize the truth of the Savior's promise, unquote. The official history did not refer next to the appearance of Peter, James, and John to confer that authority, as modern Mormons would expect. Instead, his history said God simply commanded Joseph Smith to begin ordaining men to the office of elder. Quote, we had not long been engaged in solemn and fervent prayer when the word of the Lord came unto us in the chamber, commanding us that I should ordain Oliver Cowdery to be an elder in the Church of Christ, and that he should also ordain me to the same office, and then to ordain others, as it should be made known to us from time to time, unquote. David Whitmer said that these elder ordinations, including his own, actually occurred in June 1829 and were reperformed in the newly organized church in 1830. Cowdery's 1829 articles verify Whitmer's memory. After 6 July 1830, Joseph Smith had the higher authority of ancient apostles by which he now performed all ordinations. Still, when he began dictating his official history 8 years later, Joseph Smith lapsed into the earlier view of the elder's office as part of the lesser priesthood. His history stated that in the June 1831 conference, quote, the authority of the Melchizedek priesthood was manifested and conferred for the first time upon several of the elders, unquote. This required assistant church historian B.H. Roberts to write a footnote denying what the text just stated, quote, the prophet does not mean that the priest Melchizedek priesthood was given for the first time in the church in June 1830, unquote. In fact, that is exactly what Joseph Smith and others in attendance claimed. For example, Lyman White, the first man ordained at the conference, wrote that in June 1831, quote, I was ordained by the hand of Joseph to the Melchizedek priesthood, unquote. White was already an elder. He'd been ordained an elder months before. 26 years later, Apostle Franklin D. Richards published a church chronology which included the following entry for the year 1831. Quote, June 6th, the Melchizedek priesthood was first given, unquote. Roberts' denial was necessary only because of later assumptions about LDS priesthood offices. First, that apostle meant in 1829-31 what it meant after 1835. Second, that apostle was an ordained office before 1835. Third, that the office of elder was different in 1829 to 31 from the elders of the Old Testament. Fourth, that the LDS officer of elder was always a Melchizedek priesthood office. Joseph Smith never made such claims. Old Testament elders had only Aaronic priesthood, Aaronic priesthood by later LDS definitions. The early Mormon office of elder was a pre-Melchizedek priesthood office. Joseph Smith's statements about the high priesthood in 1831 show that, by later definitions, elder was still an Aaronic priesthood office as late as June 1831. For example, the founding prophet's brother wrote of the 1831 conference, quote, "Elders, priests, teachers, and deacons received some general instructions from the church concerning the priesthood of Melchizedek, to which they had not as yet been ordained, for they had not yet attained to all the power of their ministry," unquote. Not until 1835 did Joseph Smith say the elder's office was in a different priesthood from that of priest, teacher, deacon. An 1835 revelation specified that, quote, "the office of elder comes under the priesthood of Melchizedek," unquote. That was an improvement over the Articles and Covenants of the Church, as revised in 1831, on priesthood offices that, quote, "an apostle is an elder," unquote. This 1831 statement said nothing about the authority of an elder, since by later LDS definitions, it would be equally true to say an apostle is a deacon, the lowest church office. Quote, "These different offices and callings are branches of the apostleship," as one apostle later said, unquote. However, that understanding of apostleship developed long after the introduction of the high priesthood in June 1831. Of the 12 original officers, known as apostles, at the church's first conference in 1830, nine of them, six elders, one priest, and two teachers, attended this June 1831 conference, where Joseph Smith conferred the high priesthood first on Elder Lyman White. Also present were 38 others who had been ordained as elders before June 1831. At this conference, the 25-year-old prophet was, quote, "then ordained to the high priesthood under the hand of Brother Lyman White," unquote. Thus, Joseph Smith mirrored his religious namesake, Enoch, who, according to the Melchizedek priesthood revelation in 1835, also, quote, "was 25 years old when he was ordained under the hand of Adam," unquote. Conferring the high priesthood in 1831 ended a discrepancy in the Mormon ministry. The elders ordained in the church from 1829 to July 1830 had been after John the Baptist's visit and took authority of the voice, quote, "the voice of God in the chamber of old Father Whitmer," unquote. Elders ordained after July 1830 received authority conferred by the angelic ministration of Peter, James, and John. Thus, there were elders ordained by one set of authority and also elders ordained by another set of authority. None of the elders recognized this at the time because the angelic priesthood of authority was secret. By ordaining all the pre-July 1830 elders to the high priesthood in 1831, Joseph Smith eliminated the elder ordinations which occurred before the second angelic restoration of authority in July 1830. A recent interpreter argues that the previously ordained elders received the high priesthood at the June 1831 conference, but not the office of high priest. This interpreter says that the official history retroactively assigned to 1831 the later concept of ordination to the office of high priest. It is certainly true that the original minutes continued to list men as elders at various conferences despite their ordination to the high priesthood in June 1831. The men who received the high priesthood were not listed as high priest in the original minutes until April 1832, almost a year later. Since 1829, however, Mormon theology affirmed that the office of high priest was not restricted to one man, as in biblical Judaism, or to Jesus Christ alone, as in traditional Christianity. The Book of Mormon narrative showed that many righteous men could be high priests at the same time. Also, its only references to high priesthood were descriptions of the office of high priest. Therefore, in Book of Mormon theology, high priesthood meant the office of high priest. The Book of Mormon scribe, Oliver Cowdery, was the one who recorded the minutes about the high priesthood in 1831. His minutes did not use the term high priest or office of high priest because he was following the Book of Mormon's equation of high priesthood with the office. Apparently, everyone in 1831 understood that. For example, Sidney Rigdon, according to the original minutes, spoke, quote, "to those who were ordained to the office of high priesthood last evening about their indifference to being ordained to that office, setting forth the power of that office." unquote. It is clear that the June 1829 conferral of the high priesthood included ordination to the office of high priest. Until the revelation dated September 1832, but not published until 1835, Joseph Smith and others applied the high priesthood exclusively to the office of high priest. Until then, lesser priesthood applied to the offices of deacon, teacher, priest, elder, and bishop. They were all lesser priesthood, not high priesthood. Apostle was an unordained calling until 1835. 42 years later, Brigham Young said, quote, "The 12 apostles had been ordained, and every one of them happened to be high priests, excepting Brother Heeble and myself. We were elders," unquote. Then Brigham returned to the old usage by saying that he and Kimball, quote, "had never been ordained to the high priesthood," unquote. The early development of patriarchal priesthood is almost as complex as that of the Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthoods. Oliver Cowdery wrote in 1835 that, quote, "Joseph Smith Jr. is the first elder and first patriarch of the church," unquote. Despite their emphasis on angelic restoration of authority, traditional LDS histories never explain how Joseph Smith obtained this authority of a patriarch. The explanation is that in Joseph's view, he inherited lineal priesthood without ordination. A revelation stated this in December 1832, quote, "Therefore thus saith the Lord unto you, with whom the priesthood hath continued through the lineage of your fathers. For ye are lawful heirs, according to the flesh, and have been hid from the world with Christ in God," unquote. In 1847, Brigham Young preached, quote, "Joseph Smith was entitled to the keys of the priesthood, according to blood. Still he was the fourth son," unquote. Decades later, Apostle Franklin D. Richards published that, quote, "Joseph Smith Sr. inherited the patriarchal priesthood by right from the fathers over the house of Israel in this dispensation," unquote. No form of the word patriarch appears in the published form or available manuscripts of the long revelations on priesthood in 1832 and 1835, presently published as sections 84 and 107 in the Doctrine and Covenants. The latter began, quote, "There are in the church two priesthoods, namely the Melchizedek and the Aaronic, including the Levitical priesthood," unquote. However, Orson Pratt said that the original manuscript, now unavailable, of the 1835 revelation did contain the word patriarchs, which Joseph Smith changed to the phrase, quote, "evangelical ministers," unquote. Lineal priesthood was a concept in Mormon theology as early as 1832. However, the office of patriarch and the term patriarchal priesthood did not exist until December 1834, not 1833 as traditionally claimed. But I don't have time to discuss that right now. It is significant that the 1835 revelation did not also say, quote, "In the church there is the patriarchal priesthood," unquote. Lineal priesthood, as described in the December 1832 revelation, was not a priesthood of the church. It was a priesthood of a family. According to that revelation, Joseph Smith had lineal priesthood before his first vision, before visits of any angels, before the restorations of Aaronic priesthood, of apostolic authority, or of the high priesthood. Joseph Smith was never ordained to this lineal or patriarchal priesthood by the laying on of hands. Later called patriarchal priesthood, this authority existed within him from birth. According to the 1835 revelation, quote, "The order of this priesthood was confirmed to be handed down from father to son, and rightly belongs to the literal descendants of the chosen seed to whom the promises were made," unquote. Or as the patriarch Abraham expressed it in a book of that name begun in July 1835 by Joseph Smith, quote, "It was conferred upon me from the fathers. It came down from the fathers from the beginning of time, even the right of the firstborn," unquote. Conclusion at long last. Joseph Smith's Church of Christ was announced in 1828 as an unorganized group of believers who had no priestly authority and required no baptism or any other ordinance. A year later, it remained an unorganized body of believers, yet had a concept of priestly authority and practiced religious ordinances. In 1830, this Church of Christ became formally organized as an institutional church with confirmed church members and organized branches. Joseph Smith began as a prophet whose only gift was to translate the Book of Mormon, but then later became a prophet whose many gifts included exclusive right to give commandments and revelations to the new church. The new church first emphasized the authority of charisma and later the authority of ordination and office. This Mormon authority itself began as a single authority and then a single holy priesthood and then evolved into multiple orders of lineal or patriarchal priesthood, of Aaronic or lesser priesthood and of Melchizedek or greater priesthood. Church membership changed from Mormons who knew nothing about angels restoring authority or priesthood keys to Mormons who regarded such angelic restorations as the foundation of LDS priesthood. And necessarily, Joseph Smith abandoned his 1830 refusal, quote, to add to or diminish from a revelation or commandment from Almighty God, unquote. Instead, he made unacknowledged additions in 1835 of whole paragraphs, new concepts, and previously unmentioned events to the texts of already published revelations. The next phase of Mormonism's evolution was the creation of the LDS Church's hierarchy and bureaucracy. The former began in 1832 and the latter in 1833. But that requires separate analysis. As church historian President Joseph Fielding Smith summed it up, quote, down through time there has been a gradual development in the offices of the priesthood, unquote. Thank you. Questions? Yes. Two questions, which I'll try to rephrase and then respond to. The one is relating to an interpretation of an interpretation by Lyndon Cook, which said that the Melchizedek priesthood was restored when the voice of God came announcing the right to ordain elders. And this was, in fact, the restoration of Melchizedek priesthood. All I can say about that is that Joseph Smith and others said Melchizedek priesthood was not restored until 1831. They did not connect the restoration of Melchizedek priesthood with the ordination of elder. They connected the restoration of Melchizedek priesthood with the conferral of high priesthood in 1831. I commented, the second question was, isn't it anachronistic to say that the LDS Church was organized by Aaronic priesthood in 1830? I commented in the paper that it's impossible to avoid anachronism where you have all the crucial texts having anachronistic elements added to them after their original composition. In a way of trying to explain these developments to a current church which has very rigid and current membership, which has very rigid definitions of Aaronic priesthood and Melchizedek priesthood, I said that by our current definitions, the LDS Church in April 1830 was organized by the authority of the Aaronic priesthood. However, I am following in the footsteps of Brigham Young, who made that same exact statement, that the Aaronic priesthood was the basis on which the church was organized in April 1830. I myself don't feel I can avoid anachronism because I'm doing my best to try to mediate between current understanding and earlier documents. And that mediation, I think, at least for me, inevitably involves a certain amount of anachronism, which I try to acknowledge as I go along. Yes. Yes. Two questions. I would ask if, and for future questions, if you'd only ask one question. Those of you I call on, in fairness to others who also want to speak. First question is, if I'm trying to reconstruct it now, how widely was the concept of lineal priesthood, which came down through families, how widely dispersed was that? During Joseph Smith's lifetime, the only statements about that were limited that inherited priesthood to the Joseph Smith family, Joseph Smith Sr. family. After Joseph Smith's death, Brigham Young said that inheritance of priesthood applied also to Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball. There is the December 1832 revelation that I originally referred to was given to a group of people, a group of men, and so one could understand that as applying to Joseph Smith as well as Oliver Cowdery and the others who were there on the occasion. However, outside that revelation, during Joseph Smith's lifetime, the inherited priesthood was always limited to the Joseph Smith family. The second part of the question was, how does that relate concerning lineal priesthood during Joseph Smith's lifetime to a belief of the of Mormons that Christ fathered children, and that those children had descendants that continued down through the present into the Latter-day Saint Church. This isn't folk belief in the sense that it isn't unauthorized, it isn't something that is simply word of mouth. This was preached from the pulpit by leaders of the church beginning in the 1850s. I find no evidence of it, though, before the 1850s. But from the 1850s onward, it was preached that, that Jesus Christ was married, that he was a polygamist, that he had numbers of children, that those children had descendants, that those descendants passed down through the generations, and that among Mormon converts in the 19th century were literal descendants of Jesus Christ. And among those literal descendants, specific individuals were identified, Joseph Smith being one of them, George Buchanan, John Taylor, Brigham Young, and others. Not all of the prominent leaders were identified, but those who were identified were all prominent leaders. Yes, question at the front. My evaluation of the calling of patriarch is that these events occurred in 1834, not 1833. But there's I have to lay that out. I don't have time to lay out the evidence. Yeah, I explain why he said it was 1833. But the evidence I have is that it was in fact 1834 that this occurred, not 1833. Yes, toward the back, green striped shirt. No more question? Oh, okay. Yes, front. It's been suggested that Sidney Rigdon was the question was, what are my thoughts about Sidney Rigdon's role in the conferral of high priesthood in 1831? It has been suggested that by many who were most of whom were hostile to Rigdon or hostile to Joseph Smith or both, that Sidney Rigdon was an evil genius, kind of bringing into 1831 Mormonism many things that Joseph Smith had not originally considered. I really don't explore that because to me is one of the imponderables, and I don't find any compelling evidence that Sidney Rigdon had this influence. It could be that he was one who suggested things, just as Emma was the one who suggested the limits on tobacco and alcohol that later became a part of a revelation when Joseph Smith inquired of God concerning the original inquiry. So it's possible that Sidney Rigdon said something and Joseph Smith inquired of God concerning it, but I don't have evidence that Rigdon himself was the origin of the high priesthood in 1831. Yes? Well, the question is, all of this is very interesting, but so what? And that unfortunately is a question that's asked of historians a lot of times, and I mean, I just have to say that the so what is, I find it really interesting to find out what happened in the past. Toward the back. All right, the question was, what was the significance of the appearance of Elijah in 1836 as it related to patriarchal authority, the keys of sealing, and the office of patriarch spiritually over a line of descendants. My limit on this chronologically was up to 1835. I do discuss the role of Elijah, and that visit is extraordinarily important because from 1835 onward, Elijah becomes the most prominent angel in terms of restoration, and Joseph Smith repeatedly refers to Elijah in relation to patriarchal authority, in relation to Melchizedek priesthood, and in relation to ordinances, and in relation to the eternal worlds. And so that visit of Elijah in 1835 is extraordinarily important. I just don't have time to deal with that, except to affirm basically what you were implying in your question, that visit is crucial for later concepts of priesthood and saving ordinances. My only final comment will be, and maybe as a follow-up to the question of so what about the study of these early developments from unaltered documents, is that my personal conviction is that I believe in gold plates. I believe in an angel Moroni. I believe in John the Baptist coming and conferring priesthood and authority to Joseph Smith. I believe in Peter, James, and John appearing. I believe in God and Jesus appearing to Joseph Smith as a what is known as the first vision. I believe in a literal authority that is important for all the world to receive. However, my beliefs, just like David Whitmer's disbelief, are irrelevant to the study of history. And so I seek to use the evidence, and historians are always limited by the available evidence, to try to understand in time sequence what happened. And I thank you.
This session is adjourned. Thank you.